Hatadoyu. That's a Nias phrase meaning, what's your name? On an island like Nias, a wave is never just a wave. This is a place where hard to follow convoluted local politics merges with murky mysticism. Everything is connected, even surf travelers, farmers, and the spirits of southern blues singers. My name is Phil Goodrich, and this is A Surfer's Path, Episode 3. The following story is based on actual events and a dream. Happy Halloween. The chief of the village was drunk when he took me to the ancient tomb of the former warrior chief of Hili Sitaru. High on a hill above the coconut palms was a fantastic monument with finely carved dragons writhing around its pillars. From the balcony of the tomb, I saw the wave wrapping into a small bay. I asked the chief about it, but he quickly changed the subject. He just wanted me to play a song.
Rockstar,
he slurred. What should I play?
Elvis.
I really didn't know any Elvis songs. In fact, I still don't know a complete song from start to finish from anyone. Just riffs and pieces from lots of songs, but definitely none from Elvis. So we settled on Metallica. This seemed to make him happy, and when we returned to the subject of the wave, he explained that because he was the new chief of Hili Sitaru village, that he got to name the wave. And it was called Rockstar. I've always hated that name for the wave, and I still adamantly refuse to call it that. So when I speak about the wave, I call it by the name of the village, which is Hili Sitaru, or sometimes Durian Point, because I like that better. Durian is the king of all fruit, and when it ripens, it emits an odor so pungent that some people claim it attracts the ghosts of blues singers from the exact opposite side of the globe, deep in the southern delta. By the time the odor reaches the Mississippi River, the smell is just faint enough to be sweet, and some people even describe it as sexual. The lonely ghosts of blues musicians like Robert Johnson, Buka White, Blind Willie McTell, Lightning Hopkins, and Lead Belly have all made the ghost pilgrimage to this tiny village called Hili Sitaru. This is a wave shrouded in mystery and tragedy. The ghosts that wander through the village are drawn to the smell of their last sexual encounters on Earth. The surfers are drawn to the esoteric and mystic qualities of this wave that breaks over razor-sharp coral and is partially hidden in plain sight along a road between two rickety bridges. At sunset, the drunk chief and I walked through the village. I was searching for a papaya stem, because it makes a great smoking pipe, and a proper view of the wave. An old man sputtered something to me in Nias language. I asked the boy who was following us and serving as a translator what the old man said.
He said to pull up your pants. You wear them too low,
said the boy. The chief just laughed and shouted,
Rockstar!
With a rolling R. At that moment, a faint voice drifted into our midst. It was blues music mixed with the sound of snorting pigs and bleeding goats, pounding surf. Music in a language that I recognized, that carried the same loneliness that I felt. I took a hit from my papaya pipe and closed my eyes to follow the sound to the front of a tiny bungalow. It looked like all the others along the road except for the enormous pile of durian skin, which is spiked and ominous, like some kind of medieval torture device. We pushed open the door, and there in the shadows sat the ghost of Buka White. He paused in the middle of his song when he heard the door open. He shot us a look and continued his song. The lyrics were a warning about women. There was pure and beautiful agony in his words. His song explained that once you give your woman everything she wants, she'll surely leave. Jealousy, envy, and drunkenness were other things that the song warned about. The unmistakable smell of ripe durian was overpowering. Buka paused and said,
"A true bluesman ain't concerned about money, son. We do it for the love. We love the travel, the struggle. You get paid enough to go big for just one night and move on to the next gig, son."
His scratchy voice vibrated off my skin, and at that moment, I realized this wave I was chasing and the paintings I recently finished were my blues song. My lyrics were the things I was willing to cast aside in order to arrive at this moment. I began to understand that few people really care about some lethal wave on a tiny island in the middle of the Indian Ocean. They might seem a bit amused at the beginning of the story, but they quickly tune out, and they'll never fully understand how riding a wave like this one can affect your life. The presence of Buka White slowly faded with the ending of his song, and as I scanned the room, I noticed a window in the proximity of the ocean. A wave peaked quickly and snapped out of view. This snatched up my attention, and I rushed forward to watch the wave's progress. My heart started to pulse as I realized that in this tiny cove was a playground. The wave zipped along, gaining speed as it warped and peeled through three different shaped sections. It squared off at the end as if to take a bow, and then rudely spit at the audience. It was hidden from the road's view, and cut off on both ends by a series of bridges, which were nothing more than rotten planks and slippery steel. This village wave was a true secret spot. An hour away was the famous Lagundri Bay, and that was sold out long ago to the whims of an international group of travelers seeking to digest their piece of surfing's mythical mecca. The beauty of this secret was guarded and shrouded behind a tall tale based on a real twofold tragedy. 1998. A feud between neighboring villages was born from a classic plot involving a young virgin girl from Teluk Dalam and her entanglement with the son of a prominent durian farmer from Hilly Sitaru. The durian farmer was a drunkard, but was considered rich by the standards of the village. He had delusional expectations for his son to attend university somewhere in Jakarta. The big city seemed like another planet to his son, who was content with the simplest pleasures in life, and wanted nothing more than to settle down in the village and build a life with his young girlfriend named Yusnidar. She was the daughter of a Teluk Dalam fisherman, poor as the day is long, but extremely beautiful. It was a unique kind of beauty, anchored in a plain face, a lazy eye the color of sea foam, and a gap-toothed smile. The durian farmer despised Yusnidar, because as he got drunk every evening, she seemed to transform into the image of his estranged wife. It had been a decade since his wife decided she could no longer stand his drinking and abuse. She ran off to Jakarta with the farmer's former exporter of durian. The farmer's delusions would cause him to verbally abuse his son's girlfriend. He could vividly see all the best qualities of his wife in Yusnidar, and he hated himself for driving her away. His own expectations to reclaim his wife were pinned on his son, who had no interest at all in attending a university in a city like Jakarta, where Muslims bombed Christians and Christians sold out to big businesses that adopted Western decadence and fueled the hate of the Muslims. His son wanted nothing more than a simple life in the village with Husnidar. He thought perhaps he could join forces with her father and just learn how to fish. For the 18th birthday party of his son, the durian farmer organized a banquet in which 3 pigs would be slaughtered for the occasion. The parents of Husnidar were invited, along with about 100 people from the neighboring villages. At the height of the celebration, which coincided with the height of the farmer's drunkenness, a song by bluesman Robert Johnson crackled from the battered speakers. Indonesians are fond of their karaoke, and the farmer began to call attention to himself by singing along to one of his favorite blues songs of all time. He could really identify with the painful falsetto crescendos of Johnson's voice, and he felt his own voice was quite the match. His painful rage began to bubble over when he spotted Husnidar. The way she gazed at his son with total devotion seemed like a mockery to his sad story of loss. He began to direct the song to his son's love interest, which drew a crowd of smirking villagers. They knew from experience and rumor mongering what was about to happen. Virginity is a valuable commodity left over from a more primitive time in the society of Nias. A high price is paid in the form of a dowry, even in this modern age. As the farmer's voice became louder and more overpowering than the whole commotion of the banquet, he decided to freestyle some lyrics of his own, which blatantly questioned the validity of Husnidar's virginity.
Pure-hearted woman, so expensive these days. A price so high, you're never the same. The deeper the jungle, the cheaper the price. A fisherman can sell his daughter's lies. Just patch up the goods, her beauty slides right past the blame.
A horrified look of utter shock spread across Husnidar's face. Her proud fisherman father's contorted rage spread quickly to her oldest brother and then to her cousin, who secretly carried a romantic crush for Husnidar. It wasn't long before anyone in attendance from Teluk Dalam was swept up into the flames of anger, all caused by the pathetic, blundering lyrics and awkward Elvis gyrations from the foolish durian farmer from Hilly Sitaru. In this warrior society, where 2 generations prior were hunting each other's heads, it didn't take long for the celebration to turn into a brutal war. Depending on whom you asked, arms were severed, skulls were mashed like watermelons, and fires were strategically set, all to the soundtrack of blues music. After the skirmishes at the banquet, all travel and commerce between the 2 villages became potentially detrimental. Teluk Dalam was a much larger village that overlooked the main seaport. Hilly Sitaru may have been a much smaller village, but it controlled all of the durian fruit trade. Simple business transactions became opportunities for covert revenge tactics. Along the tattered jungle road, travel and communication became less and less trustworthy. A few weeks after the chaos began to settle, the son of the durian farmer made his way cautiously into Teluk Dalam. He had an apology speech prepared and a pocket full of money with the intention of paying the dowry for his love, Husnidar. When he arrived at the bungalow of her family, he could see that the fisherman's boat had not yet returned. Husnidar's oldest brother and jealous cousin sat playing cards and drinking locally brewed rice vodka called Asoka. His greeting of Yahob received nothing but a bloodshot stare and a jealous glare. So the durian farmer's son decided to wait for Yusnidar's father on the beach. It was approaching sunset as he sat on the sand and watched the octopus hunters pick through the reef. The brilliant, brutal glare obscured the fisherman's outline as he skillfully bobbed into the reef's narrow channel. The durian farmer's son remembered the countless times he would rush down to help the old man drag his outrigger canoe back up to the beach and under the mango tree. The young man wasn't a fisherman yet, but he loved to hear the old man's style of storytelling, and he adored the sight of a boat full of shiny fish. As he approached the old man in his canoe, he noticed the scowl on his face and was taken aback.
I can do it myself,
the old man sputtered. He watched the old man's rippled and gnarled arms straining under the tension of pulling a canoe full of water and fish. It took great restraint to hold back from helping as the man's veins and tendons struggled pathetically. He began to follow the old man up under the tree and started into his well-practiced speech. The old man snapped at him again.
Save your breath.
It was a struggle to hold his tongue, thinking of how much time and respect he had paid this man over the 3 years that he had patiently courted Yusnidar. The farmer's son realized the futility of this attempt and decided to regroup his approach and try reasoning with Yusnidar's mother. As he walked back towards their bungalow, he could see Yusnidar and her agile, protective mother slowly collecting the laundry from the clothesline. It was this vision of Yusnidar in the purple-orange sunset light which caught him in a trance. The colors seemed to refract off the white laundry fluttering in the breeze, and at that moment, she had never looked more beautiful. Had he not been so caught up with the sight of her, he would have certainly noticed Yusnidar's brother and jealous cousin crouching behind some palm trees, one with a gasoline can and the other with a torn fishing net. As he reached the trees, he was met with the sound of metal colliding with skull. When he awoke, the farmer's son could smell gasoline and taste the metallic tinge of blood in his mouth. He could feel something gouging into the delicate skin between his lip and nose, but he couldn't remove the torn fishing net which he was now tangled in. Everything slowed down. He heard the click of the lighter and saw the look of helpless horror on Yusnidar's face. The heat came over him in a breeze, and the smell of his own flesh burning overwhelmed him. He became filled with searing anguish about the fact that it was too late for anything else. July 2002. It seemed extra crowded that week at Lagundri Bay. A new influx of hungry surfers had just arrived, and it was at that size where anyone and everyone could enjoy the waves in the bay. I had heard about a wave a few kilometers to the west that picked up more swell and was usually empty. Once you walk past the last guest house and the ghostly remains of the failed resort hotel, it's easy to imagine what it might have looked like to the first surfers that arrived to Nias. The jungle meets the sand again, and the raw beauty of the island wipes away any frustration that occurs at the sight of a crowded lineup. As I approached the wave named Subatu, I could see that it was definitely a few feet bigger than the bay. The takeoff area was less defined, and there was no obvious channel. As I scanned the lineup, I spotted a lone figure patiently waiting for a wave. I watched as he spun around and scrambled into a large set wave. A moment of hesitation left him caught in the lip, and I cringed in horror as he launched headfirst into oblivion. It was the type of wipeout when a loud groan or expletive escapes your mouth even when you're alone. I was relieved when I saw the dude pop back up and scramble over the next few waves. When I joined him in the lineup, he was undeterred and smiling like a maniac.
Did you see that last one, man? That was so gnarly, bro.
It was an unmistakable Southern California accent, which normally causes me some discomfort. But this guy just had infectious enthusiasm, and soon we were enjoying some challenging hollow and empty pits. After a few hours, we made our way back to the point, walking with that special strut that comes after a private and exhilarating shared experience. My new friend was named Tim, and he had an underwear model's physique, and he loved to talk. He had a boxer's face, which had surely seen some bar fights, and when he told me he was a longshoreman from San Pedro, it all made sense. He asked me if I had heard about a new secret wave just about an hour up the road to the northeast. He described 17-second right-hand barrels and razor-sharp and shallow reef. His speech increased in speed with his enthusiasm. He said the biggest problem was the road. The bridges were both washed out, so only motorbikes were able to make it across. Also, there was a leftover feud between Teluk Dalam and the village that had the wave, Hilisataru. I was enthralled but skeptical. Tim had it already planned out. He had rented two motorbikes, but the friend he was traveling with turned out to be a day drinker and he wasn't all that interested in surfing. He was leaving at sunrise and invited me to come. As we arrived back to my guest house, I gave him a polite maybe and he went on his merry way. Early the next morning, I sat with Big Mike watching clean 6-foot bombs pump into Lagundry Bay. The swell had come up enough to weed out some of the crowd, and we were enjoying the smoke from a few papaya stem bombs. Mike was a mentor to me, and I asked him if he had ever surfed the wave at Hilisataru.
Too shallow.
Was all that he said as a plume of smoke lazily crawled out from deep in his lungs. It was at that moment when we spotted L.A. Tim, my new friend from the day before. He was silently pushing a motorbike under his guest house so as not to awaken anyone else who might follow him to his secret wave. We began stirring him up, saying that we were going to bring 6 French bodyboarders, 2 chicks and a photographer to his new spot. He gave us a maniac smile behind a middle finger and sped off down the road. In that moment of my hesitation, I never imagined that it would be the last time I would ever see him. It was the amount of blood that was most shocking to the local people of Hilisataru. It flowed past Tim's desperate fingers, down his leg and onto the sand, and then into the reef. It was absurd amounts of blood. A small lagoon of scarlet mixed in pools between the rocks. The children of the village wondered silently if all Bule, foreigners, bled this much. An argument broke out between the villagers. Half of them wanted to bring the Bule to the local witch doctor, who would prepare a salve of mud and herbal leaves to clog the wound. The other half wanted to take Tim to the proper doctor who worked in Teluk Dalam, which was about 40 minutes away if the bridge wasn't washed out. No one wanted to drive Tim's motorbike into Teluk Dalam because the embers of the feud between the villages were a wisp of wind away from igniting again. Despite Tim's desperate pleas for medical attention and his aversion to seeing a witch doctor, His life expired before a decision could be made. His last words were whispered because Tim could feel the cold chill running through his body.
"Tell my mother I love her,"
he gasped. The local villager who was holding his hand swore that he heard those final words differently.
"Tell Yusnidar I love her."
His astonishment spread through the small crowd gathered around Tim. Was it possible that he had just heard the restless, heartbroken ghost of the durian farmer's son speaking through this dying bule? A shockwave rippled through Lagundri Bay. The news of a fellow surfer bleeding to death travels like a gasoline fire through a tight-knit United Nations of exotic surfing characters. Tall tales were speculated on just what caused the laceration on Tim's inner thigh, which severed his femoral artery. Was it his fin? The reef? The nose of his board? Was the wave too dangerous to surf? Too shallow? The rumors gained momentum, and curiosity got the best of me, which is how I found myself alone in a room with a view of that lethal wave. The smell of durian and the echo of Buka White and Robert Johnson was provoking me. I entered the lineup cautiously, unable to get the mental picture of Tim's bleeding to flee from my mind. My first few waves were a blur, but the amount of time spent inside the tube, mixed with the uncertainty about what might happen after falling off, combined to make it a truly exhilarating experience. July 2005. The wave in front of Hilisataru village is no longer a secret. The name, Rockstar, from that drunken chief has been adopted, despite my refusal to call it that. It's not usually crowded, and it's still a bit tricky to find. The road has been improved, but if you aren't looking for it, you can blink and drive right by without noticing it. To surf the wave is always a unique experience. If you're alone and the wind is offshore, you can hear the sound of blues music rustling through the palm trees, and if durian is in season, you can smell that strange sexual odor. For me, it's an emotional experience, because I can't help but think about that moment of hesitation when I said maybe to my friend Tim. I'm fairly certain that I wouldn't have known what to do to stop the bleeding from his femoral artery. I carry some guilt that I let him leave that morning and surf by himself. But most of all, it leaves me wondering, were Westerners like me actually meant to be traveling to this remote village on this cursed, war-torn island of headhunters in the middle of the Indian Ocean? Mungkin. Tidak mungkin. Maybe. Maybe not. This episode was written, edited, and narrated by me, Phil Goodrich. I used one song by Robert Johnson called Kind-Hearted Woman Blues. And last episode, I mentioned that I was going to interview a Nias local. I'm still working on that. Hopefully the next episode I'll be able to get you that. Please like and subscribe this podcast, possibly write a review, and also you can follow me on Instagram @PhilGoodrichArt. Thanks for listening.